Good evening. 25 years ago, in a crucial Dáil vote, Des O'Malley opted to stand by the Republic. This week, our democratic system has been held up to moral scrutiny by the resignation of another government minister. Trevor Sargent resigned, as we all know, as a junior minister after accepting that he'd made an error of judgment in contacting Gardaí about a case involving a constituent. The Green Party deputy leader, Mary White, meanwhile blamed, quote, grubby amounts of corporate donations, unquote, for bringing politics into disrepute. What, if anything, does this tell us about how ingrained the idea of undue influence is in our system? In a republic, power is supposed to be derived from the people. So according to that definition, do we actually live in a real republic? You can call us with your comments on 1850 715 150. You can text 51551. If you're calling from Northern Ireland, you can call us on 08457 853333. And we'll be checking our email, thesundayforum@rte.ie, throughout the programme. My guests this evening are Elaine Byrne, who lectures on Irish politics in Trinity College in Dublin and is an Irish Times columnist, former Taoiseach Garrett Fitzgerald. Catherine Zappone is a commissioner on the Irish Human Rights Commission. John Devitt is chief executive of Transparency International, and Edmund Grace SJ is the author of Democracy and Public Happiness. But first, we asked people if they thought there was much corruption in Irish public life.
Corruption is a strong word, but definitely none of them, I don't think any of them at the end of the day would have high ethical standards.
What Sargent did was what we did for years, people did for years. Now, I'm not a Fianna Fáil person, but that was the way life was long ago. If you could help, you knew a neighbour or friend was getting into trouble, and that you had your politician going and helping out.
I think that every political system is in some way corrupt. I think it's when a politician is elected, their first job is to be re-elected and their second job is to be a politician.
No, I just think it's all about themselves and all about what money they can get out of it. I don't think they care about the country anymore.
Most politicians don't have ethics, and the Irish public don't expect them to anymore. I think the standards of what we expect ethically from politicians, we just expect them to be the corrupt deviants that they are, basically.
Well, there's a certain amount of it. A certain amount of it, but the solve it is going to be another day's work, like, you know, the church and the government.
Well, the churches, the banks and the political system, yes, I think they're all corrupt. But I think that the political system, for whatever reason, hides it better than the other two. The banks and the church obviously are corrupt, given what's come out in the last year to 2 years.
Well, I think when people are allowed to get away and not answerable to anybody, of course it's going to be corruption. Absolute power corrupts.
Call the Sunday Forum on 1850 715 150.
So some not very high opinions expressed there on our politicians, our bankers and our churchmen, as I said. In studio, Elaine Byrne, Garrett Fitzgerald, Catherine Zappone, John Devitt and Edmund Grace. Garrett, let me start with you. We're living in a state which is, or certainly was, close to economic bankruptcy. Is it also morally bankrupt, do you think?
Wouldn't go quite as far as that. But let's start at the beginning. What is civic republicanism? It's public engagement of citizens in pursuit of the common good. And the common good, of course, means not excluding or marginalising groups in society. It involves pluralism. Now, we didn't become the kind of republic. There's a reason for that, because we had to secure independence vis-à-vis Britain, which uniquely amongst monarchies at that time had sovereignty of parliament, royal prerogative, crown forces dealing with Irish people seeking independence. And so our republicanism turned into anti-monarchism, anti-British monarchism. All the other post-First World monarchisms became quite different. In fact, you could describe most European monarchies today on the continent as being civic republics. But there you are. Anyway, that's what happened.
So we got it wrong very early, is that
what
you're saying?
Yeah, and it's inevitable. I mean, it's no good complaining about that. The whole history determines that what form the republicanism took. It was the exact opposite of civic republicanism. Well, then we had problems because we were a very early type of society. Because of our colonial history, we were tribalist. Localism was dominant, rather than really no sense of the state, because, in fact, our first elected and chosen representatives were at local level long before we ever had a state. So it was all locally oriented. Clientelism raged at the time, the Irish Parliamentary Party people. There was corruption. considerable corruption at local level. In one case, in one town, the newspaper staff got themselves elected to the local council and used the money for public housing to build houses for themselves. We had that kind of corruption at the time. That was cleaned up by the first government, and by Fianna Fáil, when they came in, they had been critical of the introduction of county managers, but they continued that. And it was cleaned up largely at local level. And, of course, we had no corruption that I'm aware of at national level in the first 40 years of the state, because our revolutionary politicians of both parties were dedicated patriots, looked for nothing for themselves, only want the good of the state. So we were very lucky in that. It lasted about 40 years.
So when did our luck change?
Well, the first government did a big, huge cleaning up job in every way, and they were dedicated civic republicans. They weren't very popular, I can tell you. When they abolished the power of local authorities to appoint dispensary doctors, that day's dispensary doctor, he had to pay £1,000, which is 50,000 euros today, for his job to local councillors. When that was done, there was a lot of reaction against it. The government was unpopular. It didn't help it to stay in power for more than 10 years. It's understandable. And then there was some deterioration after that.
But it seems like that mentality, petty government, small government mentality has kind of seeped up into the higher echelons.
Yeah, well, it was tackled then. The government today lost on that, and it gradually came worse. But we didn't have financial corruption until much later, until a new crowd of people came in. And only a very small number of politicians were ever financially corrupt, half a dozen at most, I think one could say.
Okay,
at national level.
I'm going to come back to you on that because Elaine Byrne is currently writing a book on Irish political corruption. What's your definition of the word? How would you define corruption?
Well, I see John here, and he would define it in the traditional way, which would be the abuse of public power for private gain, and how you define what private is and public and gain and things like that. But I would actually define it in terms of the Latin verb rumpere, which is the word that it's derived from. And rumpere, which is the rump in corruption, is a Latin word, and it means to break. And it's how you define what's broken, and whether it's something that's legally broken or something that's morally broken. And so for different points in our history, and, you know, you go all the way back to Plato, and I will if you want, but, you know, that there's been different emphasis on the moral or the legal side of things. So, you know, we've had various people who stood up in recent years who've said when they resigned that they broke no law and did no wrong, which is a very easy thing to say because for most of the history of the state there was no particular and specific laws on corruption. So between 1916 and 1995 there was no laws looking directly at corruption. A lot of our legislative framework derived from British statutes, and actually we had more laws on corruption introduced in Ireland as a member of the United Kingdom than any other part of the United Kingdom. But then from 1995 onwards, we've had about 30, 40 pieces of legislation on corruption, so which we've kind of went from one extreme to the other. So for much of the foundation of the state, and after that, we self-regulated our behaviour, so there was a moral onus. But then since maybe the 90s, that there's this strict definition now on the legal interpretation of what corruption is, which means that our own moral responsibility is one that is not there as it should be. So if you want to have a definition of corruption, it's one that balances your own moral obligations and then also the legal obligations that are onto you as well.
But presumably you've found no shortage of examples of political corruption if you're going to get a book out of it.
Unfortunately, I haven't, because it's a big book. So I would contradict Gareth on a few things. There was three corruption tribunals in the 1940s. There was one into the Ward Tribunal, one into Lock's Distillery, the very famous one, and then one into Great Southern Railways. And there was also...
So tribunals are not something that we would associate just with the 90s and the current decade?
No, but I would say that the distinction was, for example, in the very first tribunal, the Great Southern Railways Tribunal, which looked at incidences within Sean Lamass's department, in Department of Industry and Commerce, he reacted immediately to that. And that was the difference.
Yes.
And, you know, he was appalled, and so was De Valera, and all that generation were appalled.
But that's the kind of person that Garrett was talking about. One of the founding fathers, or the founding fathers, if you like.
Yeah, but he acted straight away, and in one incident, a civil servant was, I'm not sure whether he was compulsory retired or whether he resigned, but that was that happened.
Yeah.
And there was consequences, and laws changed, and people were made accountable.
So where did the lack of accountability creep in? Was it the kind of Thacker Crombie syndrome, if you like, from the 1960s onwards?
Yeah, Garrett and I have talked about this before, so it's great that we're talking about this again in this way. Yeah, I think what happened really was that the nature of the state changed. So in the 60s, you had demographics in Ireland change. So you had more people, for the first time in our history, living in urban Ireland and rural Ireland. So that put a lot of pressures on the state in terms of housing. And around that time, you had the 1963 Planning Act. And that gave a great onus of power to the Minister for Local Government and politicians. And those things weren't rectified then for some years later. So you had this whole, you know, Ireland was becoming more confident. We had Sean Lamassa's change of direction in economic policy with, the new departure. So Ireland was becoming more industrialised, emphasis away from agriculture. And so you had this whole new class of people who were business people, more ambitious and more competitive and more less isolationist. So as the nature of the state changed in all sorts of ways, a new behaviour began to occur. And there was also, and Garrett would agree with me, that around the 60s, late 50s and early 60s, you had a generation of politicians who were retiring, a generation of politicians who were dying, and you had a new generation of politicians on all sides of politics. So you had, like, even the leadership of the parties at that time.
We'll find out later whether Garrett would agree with you, because I want to move to John Devitt of Transparency International. How does your organisation measure corruption internationally, and how does this country compare with others on a corruption scale?
We publish what's known as a Corruption Perceptions Index annually. And this accumulates puts together the scores of around 14 different surveys conducted by mainly political risk consultancies, like the World Bank Institute, the World Economic Forum, the Economist Intelligence Unit. And it comes up with a score, a single score for individual countries, and then it ranks those countries according to the scores. 180 countries are in the index, and those countries that are at the top of the index are perceived to be the least corrupt countries in the world. And these countries include New Zealand,
Germany, Canada, the kind of places
not necessarily
we'd expect.
Canada or Germany. No, they rank alongside us.
Oh,
and they've been hit with quite a few corruption scandals in the past few years. In particular, the Canadians or Canadian politicians have been involved in kickback scandals to political parties. In Germany, there've been kickback scandals involving some of their biggest companies. They're the largest.